Welcome to Ira's Everything Bagel, where I talk with intriguing people about everything, their passions, pursuits, and points of view. Well, what do you get when you combine comedy with an atypical slant, especially in today's world, along with a popular book? Well, you get my guest, Evan Sayet. He's a speaker, columnist, stand-up comedian, political speechwriter, consultant, and an author of The Woke Supremacy, an anti-socialist manifesto. It's available on Amazon and all the usual places. And for everything about Evan, go to evansayet.com and sayet.substack.com. Let's try saying that three times, Evan. And follow him on X, Facebook, and YouTube. And Evan, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Ira. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So how did you get into this crazy business? I just introduced your 5,000 career choices, but how did you start out? Where did you get an interest in whatever
started? Great question, and good way to go about this, chronologically, because it all does fall into place. You know, when I was graduating from college and beginning to consider what profession I was going to dedicate the rest of my life to, I very luckily entered the world at a time when this brand new profession, a profession that never existed before in America, and in fact still doesn't exist in 98.6% of the world, stand-up comedy suddenly boomed.
Not prostitution.
No, prostitution's been around for a long
okay.
time.
I'll just check.
No, this was a brand new profession. Basically, I mean, prior to my generation, there were a handful of comedians, and suddenly there were hundreds and then thousands, and now even more than that. And the reason it boomed just when it did was because a new technology came along called cable television. And suddenly, instead of just three networks needing programming, 103, and now 1,003 networks needed programming, and none of them had any money. Well, what's cheaper than a stand-up comedian?
Right.
You don't have to pay for co-stars. You don't have to pay for script writers. You don't have to pay for editing. You don't have to pay for a scenery. You put them in front of a brick wall. And the other thing that was so great about it for these new channels was they could all be true to their brand. So if the women's network, Lifetime, wanted to, they had three female comedians. BET, Black Entertainment Television, had three black comedians. Arts and Entertainment had three artsy comedians. And suddenly there was all this work for comedians and almost nobody who was doing it. And so I started to do it, and I started to do it well, and I started to do it very well. Became a national headliner, then an international headliner, television shows like Late Night with David Letterman and opening for acts like Roy Orbison, and, you know, paid the bills for a good long time.
So when you start out, there were stand-up comedians prior to you, in the sense of, I'm thinking of Bob Newhart, Bill Cosby, Shelley Berman, etc. That was the beginning. Although even before them, there were comedians on radio, obviously national radio.
Well, sure, but there were 5 or 6 or 10 of them.
Correct.
There certainly weren't comedy clubs. You know, at the height of when I was doing it, there were 2 full-time comedy clubs in Norman, Oklahoma.
Right,
and that's how, if you walk down the streets in New York City, which is where I got my start, you could literally start down at the Comedy Cellar in Greenwich Village and walk 5 blocks and do a place called Foibles and do a set there, and then walk 5 blocks and do the Improv, and then walk 5 blocks and do Caroline's, and then walk 5 blocks and do Catch a Rising Star and the Comic Strip, and that didn't exist prior to the comedy boom.
Well, when you started out in stand-up comedy, did you look at it as being politically incorrect at that point, or were you doing more neutral stand-up comedy material?
No, I mean, I always had two things. I did tend to talk about culture / politics, although I was on the political left. I wasn't a leftist. I was just a New York City-born Jew in the entertainment industry. You know, voting Democrat and the narratives of the political left are simply the default factory setting for somebody born into my demographic. You know, I didn't actually change my politics until post 9/11. In fact, I call myself a 9/13 Republican, right? Because 9/11 didn't really surprise me, right? Obviously, I didn't know the date. I didn't know the targets. The amount of carnage quite literally sickened me. But even as a brain dead liberal, and sorry to the people in the audience who I just insulted, but I knew just enough about the world to know that the same people who were murdering the Jews of Israel for no other reason than that they were the closest infidels, who were murdering Hindus in India for no other reason that they were the closest infidels, who had just then recently murdered children in Beslan, Russia, for no other reason than that they were the closest infidels, would, when they could figure out a way across those giant oceans, they would come to get the big infidel, the great Satan. Of course they would. So what surprised me wasn't 9/11. It was the liberal response to the attacks of 9/11. The idea that we deserved them, that we had provoked them, that it was the chickens coming home to roost. You know, not wholly different than the liberals' response these days to the attacks in Israel on October 7th. You know, the idea that the terrorists were the good guys who were provoked by our politics. That was insane to me. And I had to start to think, if this is what liberals believe, am I a liberal? And I have an expression, Ira, the first time you think is the last time you're a Democrat.
So when you started to go in that direction and you started to do comedy in that direction, did you come up against, not opposition per se, but I assume you found your audience, but sometimes I would imagine it was mixed. So in the audience, you would have people that couldn't stand what you were saying, even though it was funny, and you had others who laughed because it was true in their minds.
Well, here's what happened, because there was a couple of years in between, because when my son was born, when my child was born, I didn't want to be on the road 40 weeks a year as a stand-up comedian, so I segued into television writing. I wrote the Arsenio Hall Show for a number of years. So I want you to take a moment and think about that. I was the voice of Black America. After that, I wrote Politically Incorrect with Bill Maher for a number of years. Did some other projects. Then along comes 9/11, and I realized that this is a culture war. And I asked myself, what weapon, what tool, what skill do I possess that people on the political right are lacking, are missing? What weapon do I bring to the culture war? And I said, we don't have a Bill Maher for the right. We don't have a Jon Stewart for the right. And so for the first time in 15 years, I put together a stand-up act, this time intentionally political, this time very pointed. And I didn't have a hard time finding an audience. What I had to recognize was that I couldn't play comedy clubs any longer, where an audience comes in not to see you necessarily, but to see a comedy show, and they trust the club enough to know that they're going to get a good show. So I couldn't play to a general audience, partly because they were so young. You know, nightclub audiences tend to be young and therefore tend not to be extremely knowledgeable about politics. I mean, in my stand-up show, I talk about more than just the cliche, you know, isn't Trump stupid? You know, isn't Bush Hitler? Isn't Reagan? It goes deeper than that. So I need an audience that's a little more involved in the political world. And so I started four-walling clubs. First, I rented out I made a deal with the Friars Club in L.A. They eventually went out of business, no fault of my own. And then I would four-wall the Laugh Factory in Hollywood. And then I started to take it on the road. But I would four-wall clubs and then advertise to local Republican organizations. And then I had a name and a reputation. And once they knew I was coming to town, I was good. I was making a living and supporting the cause.
Question for you, and I thought about this because of your background and how you approach things. It's easy enough to be, and you were the counterpoint to the kind of the liberal zeitgeist that only has liberal jokes, and you're doing conservative jokes. Have you thought about whether your conservative jokes, and I put that in quotes, of course, that you can not convert, but appeal to liberal or progressive minds and for them to see the humor in what you're saying? Or is it just met with hostility or they don't understand what you're saying?
Yeah, it's very hard when you talk about the progressives, when you talk about the left, they really do not have a sense of humor because they see everything as good and evil. They're good and everybody else is evil. And therefore, to either laugh at themselves, to show weakness, to show humility, is something they're not capable or willing of to do, nor are they willing to give our side any, you know, thumbs up that you might be right. They've replaced, and if you watch their late night comedians, they've replaced wit and turns of a phrase and humor with vitriol. Now, what we are starting to see, and this is really boomed in its own right, is political correctness is no longer the rule at these comedy clubs. There are a good many comedians who aren't necessarily on the right, but who are willing to make fun of the left. And you see this with my old boss, Bill Maher. Bill Maher has not come over to my political persuasion. He's not on the right by any stretch, but he is willing to make fun of the far left.
And do you think people like Bill, it's because they see, I don't know if the word is hypocrisy or maybe just they see the humor and contradictions within their own group. So Bill Maher, although he's not going to be a Trump fan, we'll see that it's a little over the top to accuse Trump of everything under the sun, that type of approach.
Yeah, I mean, it really depends. And Maher makes this point often. It depends. Are you really a liberal, a lowercase L liberal, or are you a leftist? Because the leftists were able to co-opt the name liberal, when in fact leftism is even more illiberal than is rightism. Because if you're a conservative, what you seek to conserve is a liberal democracy. On the other hand, if you're a progressive, you believe that you are going to progress society from liberal democracy to paradise. And so truly, if you are a lowercase L liberal these days, you're a Republican.
And I guess a lowercase liberal would be much more of a non-ideological person if you're
by definition,
you're open to ideas and you're tolerant of people that may have opposing views, et cetera. So that's interesting. So you took your show on the road. You're able to book it. You got very popular with that group. And I guess it goes back to my original question, which I'm going to rephrase a little bit because I think I didn't ask it the right way, which was, have you encountered people that once they see you who may have been either liberal or even leftist, come up to you and say, you know, you made some good points. I laughed at what you said because I could see the contradiction in my own thinking. Has it ever happened?
It's rare that, A, they are in my audience, and it's rare that when they are in my audience, they do, but it is far from unheard of. It happens from time to time.
But you personally have experienced it, I guess.
Indeed. But once again, what I find is there are so many people, and I would even put myself in this category, who thought we were Democrats, who thought we were on the left, who voted for the left because what we knew is Democrats are good and Republicans are evil. You know, I'm good, so I must be a Democrat. Who, if you go issue by issue, they're actually on the political right. You know, I find it amazing that so many ethnic groups, including Jews, vote Democrat because which ethnic group is not entrepreneurial? Blacks are entrepreneurial. Asians are entrepreneurial. Jews are on. Which ethnic group is not family oriented? Blacks are family oriented. Asians are family oriented. Jews are family oriented. Which ethnic group is not patriotic? You know, every one of the things that we associate with the political right, we associate with every single ethnic group in America. And yet the Democrats have been able to co-opt these various ethnic groups by convincing them that by siding with their own interests, they're somehow hurting themselves.
You forgot to mention Hispanic ethnic group, too.
I'm sorry. I absolutely should have mentioned Hispanic in every one of those categories.
Yeah. When did you decide to write the book? And again, it's called The Woke Supremacy, an Anti-Socialist Manifesto. Coalition of your ideas learned on the road performing and thinking. And
No. What happened was at the same time that I discovered, you know, post 9/11, September 13th, let's say, when I decided I'm going to think through the issues, I began to put together the stand-up act. But I also began to try to think, why it is that so many good, smart, decent, loving, caring, generous people, my friends, my neighbors, my colleagues in Hollywood, my family, my, you know, the people in the Jew, why do they ignore fact and reason and side always with evil over good, wrong over right, ugly over beautiful? And I'll give you just two quick examples. How does anybody look at the Middle East and decide the problem isn't these 100 million Islamic fascists, the homophobic, xenophobic, misogynistic Islamicists? The problem's that tiny liberal democracy of Jews with their gay pride parades and their woman prime minister going all the way back to the 1960s. How do you decide that they it's not only the Jews, but the Jews are the worst people to have ever lived? They're Nazis. How do you decide this is the only nation in the entire world that you are going to attempt to strangle to death economically through boycotts, divestment, and sanctions? How do you get it so wrong? And, you know, you can say, well, they're Marxist. My cousin's not a Marxist. My cousin didn't read Das Kapital and decide that's the economic system for him. You know, and you can say they're evil, but they're not evil. My sister, my cousin, my neighbor, they're not. So how is it that they think that they ignore fact and reason and think they're doing good by siding with evil, failure, and wrong? And I began to hone, I came up with this answer and I began to hone it. And I delivered the answer in a speech to the Heritage Foundation in Washington, D.C. And it became such a phenomenon. It went so stunningly viral that National Review Online put up a bulletin saying, "This talk from Evan Sayet is cramming our inboxes. Please stop sending it." And it was this talk that became called The Unified Theory of Liberalism. And I put that into my first book, which is The Kindergarten of Eden, How the Modern Liberal Thinks. The second book, I recognize that wokeism is actually a supremacist movement. And that makes it incredibly dangerous. Right? The reason we don't recognize it as a supremacist movement is because when we think of supremacist movements, we think in terms of race, right? Because of Nazism and white supremacy, because of the KKK and white. But that's not what a supremacist movement is. In fact, history is chock full of supremacist movements. Almost none of them had race as the defining trait. But a supremacist movement is this. It's one where all rights, privileges, protections, and opportunities belong only to one type of person. Now, in communism, it's based on class. All rights, privileges, protections, and opportunities belong only to the proletariat. All others are to be denied these things, fully disempowered, forever silenced and erased from history. In Islam, it's based on creed. Only Muslims are entitled to the rights, privileges, protections, and opportunities of society. What am I leaving out? But in wokeism, oh, gee whiz, there's one more important one that I can't believe I'm spacing on, but it's creed, it's class, it's tribe, it's any number that everybody outside of this one group is denied. And in wokeism, if you're not woke, then you're not entitled to free speech. If you're not woke, you're not entitled to have a job, even if that job has nothing to do with your personal beliefs. If you're not woke, you don't have the freedom of assembly. And so wokeism is actually a dangerous supremacist movement. And that became the gist of that second book, The Woke Supremacy.
Did you, in addition to, you mentioned National Review Online writing about it as well. Did you start to see an impact? And it goes back to my original question about your comedy material. Did you start to see an impact of people who normally would not agree with you on things read the book and come around to your way of thinking?
Oh, absolutely. The original speech rocked the world. And there are people who, to this day, 20 years later, about 20 years later, still email me constantly telling me how that was formative of their political beliefs and they're rejecting the political left and coming over to our side because you couldn't see, there was no way to explain it. You didn't quite believe it. But once you understand that they reject fact and reason and side only and always with evil, failure, and wrong, you see why it is they side, they want to defund the police. Who wants to defund the police? What, you know, why it is that they champion criminals, whether it's Michael, Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, or whether it was Trayvon Martin, or whether why they side with criminals and they hate the cops, why they have everything so inverted. And once you understand what I say in that original speech, right in that first book, and then expound upon in the second one, it 20 years later, Ira, not once have I had to come up with an ad hoc explanation for Democratic Party policy.
It comes actually very currently, because there's been a lot of discussion about once Trump got elected, that on the issues, they were 80-20 or 90-10, and the Democrats tended to go with the 20 or the 10, not the 80 or the 90. And they can't understand.
They went with whatever Trump didn't go with. And because Trump, by the way, is not a big right winger, not in the slightest. He's a pragmatist. He wants to get things done. And because conservatism is the pragmatist ideology, all right, the other one is the utopian ideology. You know, one of the big differences is the political left tries to solve problems. We're going to end poverty. And they come up with these gigantic programs, the New Deal, the Great Society, whereas my side tries to ameliorate problems. They try to incrementally make life better because that's the way life works. And so if you're a pragmatist, you're a Republican. And so Trump is not this big right-wing ideologue. He's just somebody who wants to get things done. And it turns out conservatism is 99.9% of the time the pragmatic ideology.
What do you think accounts for this visceral reaction to Trump, especially if you look at policies and you look at what he's done? Almost anything he's done, there's been opposition to, even if it made common sense. So what is it that causes people? I've never been able to understand that. What causes people to visceral? I understand part of it is his personality or style. You can not like the guy. But if you look, try to look objectively at policy, what specifically causes his instant reaction to be opposed to anything he suggests?
Yeah, well, first of all, you have to remember, this is not new to Trump. They called Bush Hitler. They called Reagan Hitler. They called Nixon Hitler. They despise these other people. The difference is that Trump, being an outsider, somebody who is not polished in the ways of politics, not polished in the ways of Washington, he's blunt. You know, he makes no apologies. He does not seek to compromise just because you're a fellow Washingtonian. And so they hate him because they were supposed to by now have won the Cultural Revolution. It was supposed to go from Obama's 8 years, handed off to Hillary's 8 years, and in those 16 years, they would close out the Cultural Revolution that they started in the 1960s. You know, this is where we are now, this wokeism, this insanity of the far left. It actually started in the 1960s with those they called the radicals of the 1960s. And one of the radicals was a guy named Mark Rudd. And Mark Rudd said, the true flowering of the 60s will come in the 90s when we've taken over the institutions. Well, Ira, he was only wrong because he missed the obvious. Once they had taken over the institutions, they would then need to use those institutions to brainwash successive generations into fighting their fight for them. So if it's 30 years from the 60s to the 90s, what's 30 years from the 90s?
You do the math.
Right? Which is why suddenly the political left is no longer hiding behind euphemisms. I mean, even as recently as Barack Obama, they were still saying things like fundamental transformation, whereas today Bernie Sanders calls it what it always has been, revolution. You know, it's why suddenly you see the police being called pigs again and being beaten up in the streets, just like in the 60s, because they believe that their revolution has come to fruition. And now they're ready to fight the fight. And standing between them and that is Donald Trump.
Are you, based on your own experience and your own philosophy and your own education, learning and coming to these decisions, are you optimistic about the future or pessimistic about the future?
I don't think a whole lot about the future, and I'll tell you why. One of the best pieces of advice I ever got was from a gentleman named David Horowitz. David was a 60s radical who came to his senses and then became a very strong voice against the extremism of the political left. And once he made that change, he went from beloved to despised, hate mail, death threats, you know, all the usual things you get from the political left if you don't kowtow. And early on in my conversion, I said to him, David, how do you do it? How do you get up every day seeing what you see, knowing what you know, being bombarded by what you're bombarded by? How do you even get out of bed? And he said to me, Evan, I always remind myself the future has never been what I thought it was going to be. And so I try very hard to stay out of the future, because if I extrapolate my feelings, they can, first of all, it's of no use. It's not going to change anything. I fight the fight that's in front of me. I live the life that God gave me, and that's the best I can do.
Are you working on a third book?
I'm working on, let's see, one, two, three, fourth book. I'm working on the fourth book. There's a book. It's got a very, very, very long title. It's called Magic Soup, Typing Monkeys and Horny Aliens from Outer Space, The Patently Absurd, Wholly Unsubstantiated, and Extravagantly Failed Atheist Origin Myth that debunks atheism as a scientific belief. And now this fourth book, which is going to be on happiness and why it is that the political left is so, so, so miserable. And that's not just my opinion. That's their opinion in polls that are taken. That's the scientific evidence. That's the psychological evidence. And there's good reason for it. And that's what my next book is on.
And when's that due? Is that in about a year?
When I finish it.
Okay, fair enough. Well, we'll have you back on when that happens. So before I let you go, what do you want people to take away from The Woke Supremacy if they read it? Again, it's called The Woke Supremacy, an Anti-Socialist Manifesto. What's the key point you'd like that people take away?
Right. That the idea that the political left is the tolerant movement is exactly the opposite of the truth. It's actually the political right that is, as I've already said, the liberal lowercase l ideology of live and let live. The other side is the one that says, no, you can only, if you want to have the rights in the society I control, then you have to do and say what we tell you to.
The old Politburo.
Indeed.
Well, indeed. I think that's a great way to leave it. My guest has been Evan Sayat. He is speaker, columnist, stand-up comedian, political speechwriter, consultant, and author of The Woke Supremacy, an Anti-Socialist Manifesto. It's available on Amazon and all the usual places. And for everything about Evan, go to Evan Sayat, and spelled S-A-Y-E-T, evansayat.com, and his Substack is sayat.substack.com, and you can follow him on X, Facebook, and YouTube. And Evan, thanks for being on the show.
My pleasure. You're great.
Thank you. And join us every Thursday for a new schmear on Ira's Everything Bagel.